He founded the Experimental Lakes Project of the Canadian Department of Fisheries and Oceans, conducting interdisciplinary research on the effects of acid rain, the impact of phosphorus on aquatic life, and radioactive elements and climate change on boreal ecosystems. His work has been widely used in formulating sound management policies in Canada, the U.S., and Europe. Dr. Schindler has been presented with several distinguished awards for his work, including the Stockholm Water Prize, which was given to him by the Queen of Sweden, the Volvo Environment Prize in 1998, and most recently the highly acclaimed Gerhard Hertzberg Canada Gold Medal for Science and Engineering, which was presented to him on the floor of the House of Commons last fall and included a $1 million cash award for research. Dr. Schindler's current research interests include the study of fisheries management in mountain lakes, the effects of climate change and UV radiation on lakes, and global carbon and nitrogen budgets. And he's here today to speak to us about the myths of abundance, Canadian fresh water in the 21st century. Please join me in welcoming Dr. David Schindler.
Thank you, Doug, and thank you all for turning out to hear me today. I think as we all come to work in the morning, breathing our share of forest fire smoke this early in the year, and walk through the garden and kick up dust and go to the lake and see the lake levels down, we're wondering what's happening. What I'm going to give you today is my take on what's happening, with an emphasis on the Western Prairies. But there's some bigger things that I think are part of the whole action. I think that we as Canadians have been lulled to sleep a bit by the thought that we have a lot of fresh water in this country. We've been a little bit mystified as to why all of a sudden we're getting the Walkertons and the North Battlefords cropping up, as well as seeing our lakes and streams dry up. There's a number of things. I could give you about 8 hours of lecture on them, which of course I won't do today. So I'll tell you a few key elements. Number one, I can remember in the mid-1980s, following the Pierce inquiry, that we were supposed to have a federal water policy. It was developed by Environment Canada in 1987. And it was supposed to be administered by the Inland Waters Directorate, part of Environment Canada. But it never happened. In fact, in 1993, as a cost-cutting measure, the Inland Waters Directorate was disbanded. And at about that same time, in the interests of cutting the expenses to government, both federally and provincially, Environment Canada, Fisheries and Oceans Canada, and most provincial agencies that do the same job, including the ones here in Alberta and, of course, in Ontario, were severely cut as well. So we cut the expenses of the people who were monitoring our water supplies and could have let us know what was happening in the interests of cutting costs and reducing taxes. Of course, the politicians didn't tell us any of this. These were all lazy civil servants who were being fired. Nobody ever thought to ask who specifically. I think you'll find most of the bureaucrats and the people who put out glossy pamphlets saying how good they are still there. And the people who did the actual field work and data analysis are the ones who have disappeared. So right now, we find ourselves in a bit of a jackpot. The analysis after the Walkerton report came in estimates that to bring Canadian water treatment plants up to snuff will require $130 billion in the next 10 years, about a third of that for upgrading water treatment, wastewater treatment. Meanwhile, we have increasing incidence of gastrointestinal disease. The American Society of Microbiologists studied this problem, putting out a report 2 years ago. They estimated that there were 900,000 cases of gastrointestinal disease caused by waterborne pathogens in the U.S. alone each year, and 900 deaths. Almost all of them people under the age of 5 or over the age of 55. Well, if you make some simple assumptions that our water treatment is as good as American and our population is 10% is big, that gives a figure for the U.S. and Canada of a million cases of illness and 1,000 deaths each year. Yet the costs that those illnesses and the financial costs, let alone the other costs of the deaths, are never talked about. It's always the $30 billion that it will cost the oil industry if we sign the Kyoto Protocol and things like that. So what I'm going to show you now is some ideas on what's happening and why. This first map is a map of the river flows in Canada, and it's clear that we do have a lot of water. But if you can see the black dots, they represent population centers. And you'll notice that most of the water is in the north, and most of the human population is within about 300 kilometers of the American border. So simple answer is, while we have a lot of water, it isn't where we need it. And in particular, if you can see that gray and pink area at the very southern part of Alberta and Saskatchewan, the gray area there is an area that even under average conditions has less precipitation than evaporation. It's the only reason that we can have agriculture and human populations in that area is because of the river flows and the groundwater flows that originate in the snowpacks and ice fields of the Rocky Mountains. So the southern part of Canada, if it were a separate country, would not be water rich at all. The other thing that most people don't realize, we know that we've had a lot of warm years, but we don't realize quite how many. This graph only goes up to 1990. The reason for that is that that's when Environment Canada started charging $400 a reel for their data. These are five-year running means with starting in 1890. You can see that end period, which runs from 1970 to 1990, we've had a huge jump in average annual temperature. It's about 2 degrees centigrade. Well, three of the warmest years on record have occurred in the 1990s, so it's pretty clear that that five-year running mean hasn't gone down. My guess is that it's gone up a little bit, if we ever get the data analyzed. But I think that is one of the really important drivers. I'll show you a few things that set off alarm bells in the mind of a scientist. There have been a lot of studies of lake muds and the plant fossils that they contain over the years, probably 10,000 individual sites in Canada. And people have teased out what past climates were like. It's thought that the warmest climate before this past century was the mid-Holocene, 4,000 to 6,000 years ago. And other studies have shown us some pretty frightening things. You can see the 1 degree centigrade line indicating that that's their best estimate, that the average for southern Canada was about a degree centigrade warmer than at present. Well, most of us know Lake Manitoba, which I've marked here in red. That lake is the 12th biggest on the continent, and it was dry in the mid-Holocene. The reason we know that for sure is that if you analyze lake muds from that system, where the green bands are marked at depths of 2 to 10 meters in the muds, dating 4,000 to 6,000 years, it are layers of grass and grass roots right in the bottom of the lake. Lake Winnipeg wasn't quite dry, but it was also very low at that same time. And at the same time, another study from the mid-Holocene. This was done by two Alberta scientists, Steve Zaltai and Dale Vitt. They went to a number of different sites on the prairies where there were wetlands, and they took cores of the peat in those wetlands, took the bottommost segment, first peat laid down when those wetlands were formed, and dated that by radiocarbon dating. And the numbers here are the dates to the nearest 1,000 years. South of that yellow line, you can see that the numbers are all 2 to 5, indicating that wetlands weren't formed when the glaciers left in that area, as we used to believe. They were dry in the mid-Holocene when it was only a degree warmer than the 20th century, and they have only formed since that time. Well, the main driver of all of those things is evaporation. It's one thing we tend not to look at when we look at climate models and climate warming. People tend to say, oh, the temperature's going to be warmer and the precipitation isn't going to change much. It'll be great. But what they forget is that as temperature rises, so does evaporation. This is one of my own data sets spanning only about 3 degrees centigrade for the experimental lakes area. You can see this increase of over 50% in evaporation just over that narrow range in summer temperatures. To put this into perspective in another way, this is a precipitation map of Alberta, and I'm going to show you two slides from the two yellow areas on that map, the northern one near Fort Chipewyan and the southern one near Lethbridge, where precipitation is between 400 and 450 millimeters a year. This is the northern one, and those of you who fly into Fort McMurray realize that you see a lot of this if you look down from the plane. And this is Old Man Dam in the southern one, quite a different landscape. The main difference between those two landscapes is 5 degrees centigrade in mean annual temperature. So it illustrates what just a few degrees can mean in terms of water leaving as well as water falling. There are a lot of people who seem to doubt that climate is warming based on instrumental records, but there are a lot of other records that are more convincing. This is the Athabasca Tongue of the Columbia Ice Fields, the one that you drive by on the Ice Fields Parkway. This photo is from 1917. And you can see the current Ice Fields Parkway would be under the toe of that glacier. This picture was taken in 1993. The glacier had receded 1.5 kilometers. It's been losing 16 million cubic meters of water per year, more than it's regaining as snow and ice. And this is happening up and down the backbone of the Rockies and in every other major mountain range around the world. Glacier National Park just released a study about 3 weeks ago indicating that there will be no glaciers in Glacier National Park by 2030. Most of the biggest glaciers have lost 65% or more of their area already. And, of course, in this day of satellites, we have very accurate records of sea ice, and Arctic sea ice is melting rapidly. These are three different studies with slightly different interpretations, but you can see that they're all showing a rapid decline in Arctic sea ice. And birds are flying further north, and insects are extending their range northward. If anyone has worked in the Rockies for over 20 years, you can notice trees beginning to move upslope. There are lots of indicators that we are indeed getting climate warming. Now, I know that many of the people in this room have cabins on lakes across the center of this province. This photo I took at Lake Wabamun last fall, where you can get on the dock here is back off the slide about another half slide width, and it's pretty obvious people have given up putting out enough dock to get their boats in the water. And, of course, situations like that exist on Muriel Lake and Pigeon Lake and pretty well right across the band of the province. The thing that's difficult to deduce in the absence of data that we've seen, in the absence of data analyses, and the rapid expansion in industry, is how much of that is just due to the climate warming and evaporation that we've seen, and to industrial development and other human development. There are a few clues, though, which I'll talk about in a minute. But this is the good part of the prairies. This photo, if the lights were a little bit dimmer, you could see, is a lake that's about 5 miles across. That dark band are trees on the opposite shore. This is Muskeke Lake, an hour east of Saskatoon. I took this photo in March. There's no water in that lake whatsoever. And I drove around for an entire weekend and saw one wetland that had water in it. I don't know why, but all of the big wetlands are dry. And the white area at the front is the maximum snowpack for the year. If it weren't blown around, it would probably be a quarter of an inch. So that country is quite dry. The sort of thing that is an example of the spin-off that we might see from that is the fact that the biggest community east of Saskatoon, Humboldt, has run out of groundwater. They've just completed a 193-kilometer pipeline to the South Saskatchewan River. It cost the 10,000 residents of that area $32 million, which will take 30 years for them to pay for. Those wetlands, though, even if they don't dry up, as they evaporate, lay down more and more salts. This is actually Stumpy Lake in Alberta. And as the calcium carbonate precipitates out and we get more and more saline, we lose a lot of the natural flora and fauna of these lakes. Well, we've heard talk about diverting Alberta rivers from the north to the south. So Bill Donahue, a young scientist who works with me, got the river flow records for, in this case, three rivers in Alberta, the Slave, the Peace, and the Old Man, and did a long-term regression analysis going back to when records began between 1910 and 1920, right up to the year 2000. All of those rivers are down about 30 to 45% in annual flows over that century, something that for some reason no one has really looked at. So even under conditions where we're not really doing much to put demands on these rivers, that those flow rates are slowly dropping. My guess is that most of that is caused by the trend in climate warming that I've mentioned. We've seen some symptoms already. This is the Peace Athabasca Delta, right at the mouth of the Peace. This used to flood every 2 or 3 years, replenishing the perched lakes along the river and the marshes that used to support a very lucrative muskrat industry and support a lot of native people. Well, it's a very complicated system. To flood that required a huge spring flow from the Peace, which would actually lift 5 or 6 feet of ice on that river and tumble it downriver. And as shown where that ice jam marker is at the top, there are a couple of goosenecks on that river which would jam up this ice, and water would build up for several meters behind that until it would physically be too much weight for the ice jam, which would release it as a torrent and flood that whole Delta Lakes and Lake Athabasca area. The combination of regulating the spring flows with Bennett Dam and lower snowpacks and warmer temperatures have meant that we haven't got that spring flood anymore. This gives you an idea of the flows. The dark bars here are the mean river flows at Peace Point, low on the Athabasca, before we regulated the Peace. And the pale green ones are the flows since then. You can see that in order to maintain the higher winter flows that we have now, those spring flood peaks in May, June, and July have been cut to about half. So that is part of the problem, and climate change is the other part. And as we can see, the area of wetlands has gone down over 50% and is predicted to go to 20% of what it was originally. Duck production is way down, and muskrat trapping and muskrat production is down to almost zero. So we're already seeing ecological consequences on the piece due to climate warming. And I doubt whether we really want to take any more water out of that river if we can help it. Well, to look at a river that's more heavily used, this is the South Saskatchewan River. About the same length of flow record going back to 1910. And this is the change in mean flows. We're down to 20%. This is at Saskatoon, of original flows on average. We, of course, have a number of dams on that, one of the biggest ones being the Gardiner Dam, about 100 kilometers upstream of Saskatoon. But this station is just above where the people at Humboldt are taking their water supply. My guess is that if things continue, by the time they pay for that pipeline, they're going to be piping air. I walked right across the bottom of the South Saskatchewan on my trip there in March in two or three different places. There was no water in it at all. It'll get some flow from the Rockies, but there's no local snowpack that's going to feed the river whatsoever. Well, to turn now to lakes, this is, again, a 2002 projection of how much lakes will warm as the result of climate warming. It's based on the Canadian climate warming map. The sort of olive color in the north there that covers most of Canada is 6 degrees centigrade. And I think that sets off another sort of warning bell. In addition to the sorts of water losses that we've seen at Wabamun and at Muriel Lake, we will be exceeding the temperature tolerances for lake trout and whitefish in a lot of our big northern fisheries. The red lines here are temperatures for Lesser Slave Lake, for example. And they're very similar for Lake Athabasca, Reindeer Lake, and other lakes of that size. Those lakes are big and windswept, so they tend to be the same temperature top to bottom. So there's very little in the way of a thermal refuge for cold-loving fishes and other organisms. You can see it's about 18 degrees centigrade. Well, the lethal limit for lake trout is 23. So if we push those average temperatures up by 5 or 6 degrees, we'll be pushing a lot of species right to their lethal limits. So much for climate, but climate isn't all that's happening. There are big changes happening to the landscape that also impact water. Some of you have probably seen this next series of slides before. These are air photos taken near Swan Hills and of development in that area. And that multi-pointed star at the center is a common reference point. This is 1949, when there were no roads into the area at all. And then in 1964, following the discovery of oil and gas, this is what it looked like with seismic lines and roads, and the little squares are the pads for oil and gas wells. And then, of course, once you get a nice group of roads in like that, it's tempting to log it. So by 1982, this is what that same area looked like. This area around there used to support 400 grizzly bears. So by 1982, it's mostly been clear cut. This is 1991, and of course, after the land is cleared, then it's tempting to plant it. So there's very little left in the way of habitat for large mammals, but there's also some effects on water. This is what that sort of thing looks like from the air. This photo is actually taken near Lacrete, which is the latest hub of new agricultural development coming out of arboreal forest. The area in the foreground there where it looks like there's rose is actually already planted, and the water on the landscape is being drained, and more of it will be planted as it is. And the transition goes something like this. I've grown up on a farm myself, and I know that especially during dry conditions like we have now, farmers get out their biggest equipment and gradually fill those potholes in until they're big trouble if you have big machinery, until we get the landscape that farmers love but nobody else does. It looks like this. And if you're looking for any sort of waterfowl or other birds or anything on that landscape, forget it. But note that those wetlands are gone. Then the farmers wonder why their wells go dry and why it floods every time there's a huge rain, if you get any huge rains anymore. Seems to be a total disconnect in these processes. I'm going to have to go back again. I don't know why this... there we go. But getting to direct effects on water, what we see in those areas that are being deforested and opened up is that where once only fishermen who could carry a canoe or were willing to go through the woods on their skis in the winter went fishing, now anybody who can pull a starter cord or turn a key can get to the lake with a power boat and a GPS and a sonar and all the fancy equipment in summer, and a snowmobile and a power auger and everything in the winter. So we did a pretty good job of fishing down these lakes in the 50s and 60s when there were fewer than a million of us in this province with no equipment. So you can imagine what's happening now. Another manifestation of that same sort of development are what are called hanging culverts. This example is under the railway at Hinton. The lip of that culvert is 6 feet above the stream, and that used to be a bull trout and mountain whitefish stream. There's been some work done in the model forest area, and this is the worst case that Craig Johnson, one of their scientists, discovered. There are actually three culverts in this watershed that are blocking over 50% of the spawning habitat for mountain whitefish and bull trout. This, of course, is a problem that's easy to correct, but so far very little correction has been done. Then you look at what else happens to that forested land. I took this picture 2 kilometers west of where I live near Wildwood. This was forested when I moved there. And this I took last spring. This, what's now a pasture, is 25% manure cover by area after the snow melts. And again, we seem to have some sort of a disconnect. People don't seem to realize that cattle and hogs and other livestock carry the same common pathogens that cause the Walkertons and the North Battlefords and other incidences of gastrointestinal disease. So having those animals on the landscape is the same as having a lot of people on the landscape. In fact, if you look, if you use phosphorus as an index, an element that I've spent a good part of my life studying, the average beef cow is worth 11 humans, and the average hog is worth 10 humans in terms of phosphorus production. So if you sum up what we have in Alberta last year, which are the last available figures, we have the equivalent of 87 million people. And if you look at the top, actual humans supply only 3% of the phosphorus. And of course, in major centers like Calgary, we're very careful to remove that phosphorus from the sewage. But with the other 97%, we just let it happen all over the landscape. I suspect that no government would try to get away with putting in a big hole and telling 87 million people, go and crap there, and in 3 or 4 months we'll take the waste and spray it over the land. But effectively, in terms of nutrients and pathogens, that's what we're doing. And of course, our goal is to is to increase double or triple the numbers of hogs and beef cattle with nothing but the old style waste treatment for them. Well, one of the last thorough studies that Alberta Environment was able to conduct before they were reduced to less than a shell was in agricultural areas where they studied nutrients, fecal coliforms, and herbicides and pesticides. They found that almost 100% of the streams didn't comply with fecal coliform guidelines in the Canadian water quality guidelines. I think we're really lucky that the first Walkerton didn't occur in Alberta myself. And if you look at nutrient guidelines, this for protecting aquatic life, you can see that there's a very, very poor record of compliance too. This study was released publicly in 1998. And there have been a few measures to improve things, largely taken by farmers themselves. But as water declines and less water is there to dilute our wastes, I think we're still seeing a recipe for big trouble. So if you put a number of these things together, starting with the watershed, the top is the way we plan these watersheds or don't plan them now. We let farmers go around and cut all of the stream bank areas right to the edge so their cattle can wander in and out and drink and muddy up the water. And we fill in all of the wetlands because they can plant crops on them, whereas their protection in terms of filtering out nutrients and pathogens and silt is lost, and in replenishing our groundwater supplies. And we put in these crazy intensive livestock operations with big lagoons, which if they overflow in some big accidental rainstorm or something, go straight into the river with the riparian areas gone. Of course, there are things like antibiotics and hormones that we really don't have a clear picture of that are just beginning to be studied. Well, if we would plan these watersheds a little better and put the industry and cities and big livestock operations where they would do the least harm and have some incentives or some education to preserve the riparian areas and leave the wetlands in one piece, I think we'd be a lot better off. Then when you translate that to a lake, if you consider this cartoon to be a nice natural lake in the woodland areas of Alberta. In its initial condition, it had a nice forested watershed, snags and weed beds along the shore where predatory fish like pike or lake trout would lie and ambush minnows that would pass by. And because they kept the minnows down, the grazing crustaceans, the little red bodies that you see there, were numerous enough that they would filter the water, keeping the water nice and clear. And then you add humans and start with all of the watershed scale insults that I mentioned before, cut down the trees, replace them with cows or cities or septic tanks or whatever. Put people into the lake with their power boats, and of course they fish for the predators, not for the minnows. They also remove the cover. The snags and the weed beds that are protection for the fish are things people don't like in front of their houses or where they have to swim or fish. So the predators are fished down. The small fish increase. The filtering crustaceans go to practically zero. The increased nutrients from coming in from the watershed and all the things we're doing there stimulate algal growth, and the ability to filter those algae out are weakened. Well, this whole pattern has been studied to death. I could probably pick 100 papers out of my own file on this. It's even got its own name in the ecological literature. It's known as a trophic cascade, this flip-flop that happens when you remove the top layer of a food chain. And yet we're doing it across Canada, let alone across Alberta. So it's no surprise that when five scientists this spring published studies in four major drainages, the Pacific, the Arctic, the Hudson's Bay, and the Atlantic, of 27 different watersheds. They found that most of the watersheds were, the fisheries were in decline, shown by the blue areas on these bars, where 100% intact would be the top. What's disturbing is that a lot of the lakes that are in decline are ones where we're stocking. And again, it's due to habitat destruction in the lakes as well as in the watersheds, as well as to overfishing. Well, just to sum up, I think that there is a downside to the Alberta advantage. You can see Alberta here looking like an extension of the United States. It's the only place the lights seem to be on in Canada. I think as a result of increased population growth, increased agriculture, and increased industry, we need to start looking at the downside of these things. There are profits to be made from those industries, but there are also some big costs to be paid. I think we can minimize those costs and minimize the problems that we have with water by a few simple things. First thing that we need is some watershed scale planning. We've done water planning at the municipal level. Now the province has taken it over, but somehow provincial and municipal boundaries don't correspond with what nature has for its boundaries. We see some absurd things going on, like towns fighting tooth and nail to keep development out of the watersheds above them, but then they'll put in slaughterhouses or PMS farms or whatever just below the town. I can name three or four places on the prairies where that's happened. We could practice water conservation. We use anywhere from double to four times the water in Alberta that an average European uses. Particularly cities like Calgary, without water meters, use almost twice what an Edmontonian uses. And there are all sorts of other measures that we could go to, some of them blocked by peculiar bureaucracies. A developer phoned me a few weeks ago who thought it would be a good idea to put in a water conservation development. So he designed a subdivision south of Calgary, which would save all of the water that went down sinks and showers and so on, use that for flushing toilets and watering lawns and things. And he couldn't get a water permit because the bureaucrat said you have to have 100 liters of water a day per person available. He didn't have that in terms of a groundwater supply. So even though his development was designed to do the same job with 20 liters a day that other people were using 100 for, they wouldn't permit it. So we need some innovation, I think, both in agriculture and in our municipal planning. I don't think it's any coincidence that the winner of last year's Stockholm Water Prize was a Californian who designed these secondary use and multi-stream water treatment things. So we're not treating all of our water to human consumption standards and then just pouring 98% of it down the drains. I think we still need a federal water policy and a strategy to implement it, something that the federal government and our provincial governments don't seem to want to address. And finally, I think the disconnect that I've showed between the water problem that I think everybody in this room can see is coming just in terms of your daily lives and the effects of further climate warming are pretty clear. It's time that we got on with reducing greenhouse gases, because as we increase in population size, industry, and agricultural development, even with the best water conservation plans, if we warm another 2 or 3 degrees, we're simply going to be out of water in Alberta.
Thank you very much, Dr. Schindler. Very powerful message to us all, one that is going to cause us all to think before we act. And perhaps the greatest message to us is the sensitization that water is no longer to be taken for granted. In thanks, the Community Foundation will be making a $250 donation to the charity of your choice. Thank you again for your very informative words.